This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 8 states held primaries yesterday. The constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage died in the Senate this morning. A majority of Americans say a pox on both your houses in a new poll out on Congress. And 1,000 bloggers descend on Las Vegas for the first ever gathering of virtual scribes sponsored by the political website DailyCost.com. If you're thinking this sounds like our regular weekly political junkie segment, you're right. Only with so much news to cover, we're supersizing our regular visit with NPR political editor Ken Rudin. A bit later, we'll ask political pollster Andy Kohut and New York Times writer Matt Bai to join us to talk about the political landscape in the run-up to November. And later in the program, the deadly serious cyber war of Ihr Hobby 007, the most elusive and successful online terrorist ever. But first, political junkie. If you have questions about what happened yesterday and what it means for the midterm elections, about the internal struggles in both political parties or the influence of the blogosphere, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, is here with us in Studio 3A. Always nice to see you on Wednesdays.
Great day yesterday.
Yeah. While there were loads of primaries, there was one House seat decided yesterday, a special election in San Diego to replace Republican Representative Randy Duke Cunningham, who's currently serving time on corruption charges. This was a pretty interesting race.
It was, given the fact that even though it's a solidly Republican district, President Bush carried it easily in his 2 times running for president. Duke Cunningham won it overwhelmingly 2 years ago by 20 points over the same Democrat who ran yesterday, Francine Busby. But given the fact that Duke Cunningham is now languishing in prison, given the fact that there's such a culture of corruption feeling over going, you know, surrounding the Republican Party around the country and in California, and given the fact that the immigration issue is splitting the Republican Party, the GOP was very, very nervous about the election yesterday. Polls had a dead even. Francine Busby actually raised more money than the Republican challenger. And people said that, you know, if the Democrats win this seat, then there's no stopping them for November. Now, that's not what happened. Republican Bill Bray did win it by about 4 percentage points. Another Minuteman-backed third-party candidate got another 4 or 5 points. So he had about a nine-point lead over Francine Busby. Not as good as it should be in that district, but given the given the atmosphere and given what's going on with the Republican Party, I think it's a Republican victory.
As you look at that election, Francine Busby, as you mentioned, raised more money than her Republican opponent, but the Republicans still managed to spend twice as much.
Oh, yeah, no, the Republican Party knew that if they had lost this one, it would have been, you know, front page, gigantically bold headlines all across the country that, you know, GOP RIP for November, and at least this gave them a little solace.
All right, staying in California, Democrat Phil Angelides will face Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in November. Governor Schwarzenegger starts his reelection campaign today, and what, just a few months ago he was way in the dumps.
Right, and of course 3 years ago they were talking about changing the Constitution so he could be the next president. But he has rebounded. He had some battles with the Democratic-controlled legislature in California and has lost most of them. He put a bunch of referenda on the ballot last year that were overwhelmingly defeated by all the voters, so his stock was not so good. But the Democrats didn't do themselves much favor either. They had a very nasty, bitter, personal primary between Angelides and Steve Wesley, the state controller. And while Angelides did win, there's a feeling that, you know, Schwarzenegger probably could only get better as he approaches a second term in November.
And there was, we mentioned, 7 other states held primaries yesterday. Particularly interesting, I thought, in the state of Alabama, in the governor's race on both sides.
That's true. You have Bob Riley, the Republican governor, who was running against Roy Moore. He's the guy who, the former Supreme Court justice, who wanted to install have public display of 10 commandments, one of the commandments being thou shalt vote for Roy Moore for governor on June 6th. But Roy Moore actually faded badly. Riley hurt himself early in his term by proposing new taxes. I think voters got over that. And as Moore faded, Riley grew in stature and did well in the polls. As a matter of fact, pretty much demolished Moore in the primary yesterday. On the Democratic side, it was interesting. You had a specter of former Governor Donald Siegelman. Now, he's a former governor, Democratic governor, beaten 4 years ago, wanted to get his job back. But the problem was he was on trial for racketeering charges. So he would spend half his day campaigning, half his day on trial. And as it turned out, he lost overwhelmingly in the Democratic primary to a woman, Lucy Baxley, who's the state's lieutenant governor.
And there was a gay marriage amendment proposal on the ballot in that state as well.
Defeated overwhelmingly by a 4-1 margin.
Interesting race also in Montana. Democrat John Tester is going to run against the Republican incumbent Conrad Burns for the United States Senate in what's being called a closer than you might expect race, because Conrad Burns has been associated with one Jack Abramoff.
That race will be a beaut.
I
didn't think I would say that. But anyway, the problem is Jack Abramoff has taken more money than any other member of Congress from Conrad Burns has taken more money from Abramoff than any member of Congress. And that's been a big issue in his campaign. He did dispose of a Republican primary challenger pretty easily. But the Democrats nominated their best candidate, a guy named John Tester. He's a state Senate president there. The reason he's the best candidate is because the previous favorite was a guy named John Morrison. He's a state auditor. He was basically favored to win the nomination, but he was embroiled in this revelation of this extramarital affair that grew out of gigantic proportions. And the Republicans were hoping that if Morrison were the nominee, maybe scandals could counteract each other and protect Conrad Burns in November. But the cleaner Democrat got the nomination, and he's a clear threat to Conrad Burns in November.
In New Jersey, a famous name, that of Tom Kane, in this case Tom Kane Jr. His father, of course, was the head of the 9/11 Commission before that, governor of New Jersey. He's now been nominated by the Republicans to run for the United States Senate.
Well, you know, nobody knows anything about Tom Kane Jr. except the fact that he's Tom Kane Jr. No Republican has won a Senate seat in New Jersey since 1972, but the fact is that the Kane name is still well regarded in New Jersey. And, you know, you have interesting circumstance on the Democratic side. Robert Menendez was appointed to the Senate after John Corzine left the Senate to become governor. And Menendez has been involved with this is a little euphemism here, the Hudson County Democratic Organization, which has been tainted with corruption in the past.
In the past, forever.
I'm being very careful here. So Kane is trying to use that issue against Menendez and say, look, we need a change. I mean, the rest of the country, they're saying they need to change and they want Democrats in New Jersey. New Jersey, probably the only state in the country that could say we need to change. We need a Republican in the U.S. Senate.
We want to get listeners involved in the conversation. If you have questions about what happened yesterday and why, also what it means for November, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Jeff calling from Athens, Ohio.
Hey, Neil. Love the show.
Thanks.
And fascinated with the topic. My question is about the sort of Democrat that's going to do well in 2006, and in particular, what your observers think about Harold Ford Jr.'s chances in Tennessee to be the first African American elected to the Senate from a Southern state in the post Reconstruction era. Seems to be Ford, a blue dog Democrat, represents a particular wing of the Democratic Party, and is it going to be the Dean wing or the sort of Democrat that Harold Ford Jr. represents that's going to do well in 2006? And, which side of the Democratic Party is going to come out on top?
What do you think, Ken?
Well, if the Democrats are going to regain control of the Senate, Tennessee is one of the states they have to get. Bill Frist is retiring there. There's a really fractious Republican primary there. At least three Republicans are running. And what's interesting about Harold Ford Jr. is that, he is a different kind of Democrat. Of course, he's African-American, which is a different kind of Democrat. But he's also a blue dog, moderate kind of a Democratic Leadership Council Democrat, not the Howard Dean wing of the party. And if the Republican Party finds itself split, Harold Ford could win. I still can't see him winning statewide yet. If the Republican mood gets so bad and a lot of Republicans stay home in November, Ford could win the seat. But right now, I still think that's going to be the key to recapturing the Senate for the Democrats. If they could win Tennessee, if Harold Ford Jr. could win it, then I think the Democrats can win control of the Senate.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thanks.
A couple of interesting developments in New York State. The party conventions were held last week. Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, was hoping for the Republican nod in the state of New York, thinking somebody, a Republican acceptable in Massachusetts, might be acceptable in the state of New York. But he didn't get the votes for the nomination and decided to pull out of the primary.
All's well that ends well, as they say. No, I don't know who says that, but if they did say that, they would say it about Bill Weld. This is somebody who basically was anointed annoyed by the Republican establishment in New York. George Pataki is retiring after three terms. Pataki and the state Republican chairman said Weld is the guy, even though Weld served his two terms as governor of Massachusetts. He was born in New York, and he's a New Yorker now. But Weld never worked for the nomination. He was pro-choice, pro-gay rights. Not a great position to take. Maybe in Massachusetts is a good position. But New York, when you have a sizable conservative Republican group there, it hurt. And he was outworked and outflanked by a guy named John Faso, a former state assemblyman who's already backed by the Conservative Party. And Weld got creamed last week at the Republican State Convention. And suddenly this you know, anointment, this guaranteed Republican nomination just disappeared completely. And he was pressured to get out of the race. And as it turned out, he did yesterday.
A couple of other famous names, one on the Democratic side in California, one on the Republican side. The Republican Pete McCloskey, almost a legend in his party, ran against a fellow Republican in the primary and got beat.
Well, he's a legend. I don't know if he's a legend in his party, but
well, that's true.
The fact we remember him most because in 1972 he challenged President Nixon for renomination on an anti-Vietnam War stand. He was served in Congress until 82 when he ran for the Senate. He's been out of public life since 1983, but he ran against Richard Pombo, and the reason Pombo was thought to be vulnerable is because he also took money from Jack Abramoff, and given the fact that Pombo has a questionable environmental record and there's some ethical questions, McCloskey thought he might be right for the picking, but Pombo won with over 60% of the vote.
And former Governor Jerry Brown running, now the mayor of Oakland, but running for state attorney general for the nod.
Right. I mean, the problem with the term limits is that you keep having to hopscotch from office to office. But Jerry Brown, who used to be the Secretary of State of California, then governor of California, then ran for president three times. Then now he's the mayor of Oakland. Now he's going to be the Democratic candidate for attorney general. And his job is going to be replaced, filled by former Congressman Ron Dellums, who left Congress years ago and now will be the next mayor of Oakland.
All right. Political junkie Ken Rudin with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back, we'll be joined by Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. A new poll is out that interesting results for both political parties. And later we'll be also talking with Matt Bai, who writes about national politics for the New York Times Magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A big week in politics. The marriage amendment goes down in the U.S. Senate. California now knows who will be running for both political parties for governor, and both parties aim for control of Congress come this fall. To make sense of it all, we've called our own Ken Rudin, and despite that, we might find out what makes sense of it all. And we're also going to be talking about, in this giant-sized version of our regular Wednesday political junkie feature, you're invited to join us, of course, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. That's if you have questions about what happened yesterday, what it means for November, and what the political landscape looks like for the next 4.5 or months or so. And joining us here in Studio 3A, this is Andy Kohut. He's the director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. They have a new poll out. And Andy, there's some interesting results that people find Congress has not done very much. This is bad news for the president, bad news for the Republican Party.
Well, the public is mad at Washington. Generally, you know, the president's approval rating is 33%. The Congress's rating is below that. It's in the 20s. President Bush's rating is materially lower than Clinton's and Reagan's were at this point in the second term. And most importantly, President Bush's ratings are below what President Clinton's were back in 1994, when his low popularity was seen as a factor in the Democrats losing control of the House.
People asked him if he was irrelevant at that point. Yeah.
That's right. And so the public's mad at Washington. They've got a long list. They've got Iraq. They've got gasoline prices, any one of a number of domestic issues that they don't think are going very well, and not to mention the scandals. And they're in a mood to to see change. We have the highest percentages of people telling us in so many words that they're going to be thinking in national terms when they pull the lever in local elections. The highest percentage saying that they will be thinking about which party controls Congress, 56% in this poll. Generally, it's below 50%. We have the largest percentage since 1982 of people saying that they will be voting against the president. Against the president when they cast a ballot for a member in their district,
mm-hmm.
And a big surge of anti-incumbency.
Interesting. the people who were most telling in this poll saying that are independents.
That's right. In most of the fall off for President Bush and for the Congress generally has been among independents. The Democrats were down on Bush after the last election or before the last election, and the erosion of Bush's popularity and discontent with the state of the nation is mostly on people in the middle. You know, we hear a lot about base. This is an era where base politics is thought to be everything. But in the end, it's the independents. Independents who decided the presidential election in 2004, and I will say, make a prediction, they will decide this election too.
Let's get another listener in on the conversation. This is Grant. Grant calling us from Sacramento in California.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Neil.
Sure.
I, as a member of the Green Party, without being particularly partisan, I'd like to say that at least this party has offered a clear alternative to things like Iraq and oil and now global warming that Al Gore is bringing up. And I'm kind of wondering in general, how does it look like both this election and the future that third parties in general will fare?
Andy?
We don't see, we have long-term measures on would you like to see a third party play a more important role in politics, American politics, or something like that. And we don't see an upsurge in that. You know, back in the early 1990s, around the time that Ross Perot played a big role in American politics, there was a great deal more interest in third parties. But it's not there. There's a lot of anti-establishment, but it hasn't resulted in people looking for another party at this point.
Yet there's a fascinating little tidbit in your poll. You ask people a one-word description of both political parties, and for Republicans, most say conservative, then fair, then good. For Democrats, liberal, then fair, then good. The fourth description of both parties for Republicans is greedy, and for Democrats is weak.
That's hardly a ringing endorsement of the two national parties. But I think perhaps one of the reasons we haven't seen any kind of groundswell of support or interest in a third party is that there are no national figures, as there was in the case of the late 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. with Perot making that a case. You know, all political movements need political figures to get them launched and to make them real to people. And that isn't the case.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Grant.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Andy, you know, as we look at this, you say there's widespread sentiment for change. But as we've heard from all of these places and people like Ken Rudin saying, there aren't all that many seats that are actually competitive, maybe 35 or so this coming election in the House of Representatives. And it's going to be really hard for Democrats to make up those 15 seats and take control.
Glad you asked that. Let's do the math. In 1994, the Republicans had to win about half of the competitive seats to make the Taos change. And there were about 45 seats, I believe. Wasn't it 45 seats required? Mm-hmm. And they won half. Now, for the Democrats to regain control, they have to win about half of the competitive seats. Half of 35 is 17, and I think 15 or 16 is what makes the House move. So in relative terms, the task is about the same. There's no question, though, that there are fewer competitive seats. But then again, the levels of discontent are even higher than they were in 94 at this point. We can't make a forecast that they'll be that way in November, but they certainly look that way now.
Ken?
I was just thinking what Andy was talking about, how so many people in the poll said that they're going to vote against President Bush or they're going to vote against the president because even in the local races, and Tom Reynolds, who's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, said today or yesterday following the results in California 50 that there is no national wave, that people will be voting on local candidates, on local concerns and local personalities. But as Andy's proven and those facts and, you know, those numbers show that if there's any kind of a wave out there, if there's an if it's an anger, if it's an anti-incumbent wave, an anti-Republican wave, Republicans who should have nothing to worry about could be swept away as they were in 74 and as Democrats were in 94.
Candy?
Let me just add some numbers to this. In 1990, to show what this represents, in 1990, only 22% said their member did not deserve reelection. That went up to 29% in 94, the previous high. It then stayed at 20% in 98, 19% in 98 in 2002. It's now back up to 28%. Obviously, most people are going to be reelected, but the small boost in the relatively small boost in anti-incumbent sentiment is what makes this an interesting phenomenon.
And when we talk about anti-Bush numbers, I mean, nationally, he may only be getting 30, 32, 33%, but in some of these swing districts, like upstate New York, which is hurting badly, his numbers are like in the low 20s, and that's really hurting Republican turnout as well.
Right. And let me just make this point. This is not a forecast that the Democrats are bound to win the House, but the numbers are so much more favorable toward real loss of one-party seats in a congressional election, more so than any time since 1994, and 1994 was more so than any other time for a long time prior to that.
Now let's get another caller in, Marianne. Marianne's calling from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Yeah, my question is about, sort of ties into what your commentators have been talking about, but it's specifically about the money. Like, especially if you look at how much, I think it was $5 million that the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee spent in the California 50th, it seems like a lot for what wasn't really a very sweeping victory by Bill Bray in what's supposed to be a pretty safe Republican district. Now, obviously, they can't spend that much to defend every single Republican seat. So how do you think they'll be allocating resources in the fall, or where's the money going to go?
Ken?
Well, actually, there was a report not too long ago that showed that Democrats were outraising the Republicans on the Senate side. And given the fact that, you know, most of the vulnerable Senate seats at stake this year are Republican seats in Pennsylvania, in Rhode Island, in Ohio, in Missouri, possibly Tennessee, that's where the money will go, obviously. And, of course, the more there's a sense that Democrats have a shot of recapturing either the House or Senate in the fall, more money will come in.
Let's bring another voice in on this particular point. Matt Bai is with us here in Studio 3A. He writes about national politics for the New York Times Magazine. He's working on a book due out next year about the new wave of Democratic politics. And Matt, nice to talk to you again.
You too. Nice to be here.
And this issue that Marianne is calling about, the allocation of resources, this is the subject of an argument ongoing in the Democratic Party.
It's the subject of a very strong argument ongoing, because to answer, to pick up where you guys just left off and talking to the caller about the Republican money, the difference is, yes, Democrats are outraising in the Senate committee and the congressional committee. They're outperforming expectations consistent with the kind of energy you see out there for change. However, the Republican National Committee is expected to spend what it normally spends. I don't have the numbers at my disposal, but it will exponentially increase the amount, or significantly increase the amount that the committees on the Republican side are able to spend on these races. On the Democratic side, there's a debate going on because Howard Dean, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, wants to use a lot of his money in the committee, first of all, for a 50-state strategy. That is a strategy that goes into a lot of states that are not contested this year, but that is meant to be a long-term strategy to build the party. And he does not want to use a lot of money for TV ad buys, because Dean's feeling is that television simply isn't that effective, and really acts as a sustenance program to Washington consultants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal of concern at the Senate committee and the congressional committee on the Democratic side that the money they need to compete in some of these contested races with television ad buys, with the kind of field program they are used to the DNC setting up on its own, that these things will not be there in November.
Right. The Rahm Emanuel, the chairman on the House side for the Democrats, wants to use this money tactically. Let's win this election. It's winnable now. Focus the money on the seats that are contested. And Howard Dean going for perhaps a more strategic approach. Let's build the party nationally, and we'll reap the benefits down the road.
Exactly right. And the DCCC wants a check. I mean, they want the DNC to say, this is the money you gave us in the past. Give it to us again. We know how to spend it. States don't know how to spend it. And Howard Dean, who's very much elected by the state party chairman, is saying, look, states know how to spend their own money. I'm going to let that money go back to the states, and the states will figure out how best to allocate it in their own races.
But when Howard Dean was elected chairman right after the 2004 election, he said that Democrats can't just compete in 17 states for the presidency. If you look at the Kerry numbers, if you look at the Gore numbers in 2000, it was really 15, 16, 17 states that Democrats were competitive in. You're right, Democrats want to win now, and they can win now. They certainly have the opportunity to win now, as Andy's numbers show. But as Howard Dean has said, you know, you need more than 17 states if you're going to have a chance of winning the presidency in 2008 and beyond.
Well, and he continues to say it about five times a day. I was just with Governor Dean in Las Vegas and in Alaska last week, and he is an absolute apostle for this message that you have to build a party from the ground up, precinct by precinct, and it takes long-term investment, and that's where he sees his priority.
We're talking with Matt Bai, who writes for the New York Times Magazine about politics, with Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, and with our own political junkie, political editor for NPR, Ken Rudin. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Marianne, I've forgotten you. Thank you very much for the question. I think Marianne has forgotten us, too. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Rose on the line. Rose in Indianapolis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
I'm just curious. I mean, it ties into the DNC question previously we were just discussing, but from yesterday's results, do you see much of a formation of a different Democratic strategy? I mean, we heard a few months ago Nancy Pelosi saying that she thought the best strategy was simply letting the Republicans self-destruct. But if you look at what happened with the election with Kerry, it seemed like the American public really didn't see Kerry as an alternative, and simply not being satisfied with Bush wasn't enough. Do we see much of a shift in the Democratic Party in trying to create alternative answers, or is it really just still relying on the failure of the Republican Party?
Mm-hmm. Of course, midterms are different from national elections, but Matt Bai, what do you think?
Well, midterms are different. I mean, the short answer to your question is no. I don't think there's any change. I don't think Democrats are in a huge hurry to offer up a very specific agenda. They have five or so items on an agenda, which they do repeat. They have a slogan, Together America Can Do Better. All of it doesn't amount to a whole lot new or other than what you'd expect. And I think they are counting on Republicans essentially to self-destruct. Now, in midterms, though, it is important to remember these are, you know, from a Democrat's perspective, they've recruited people who they think can run strong in local races. It's very likely, as Andy's poll numbers, that's a great poll, and as the numbers point out, it's very likely that this kind of tremendous dissatisfaction with president and Republican leadership can translate by itself into victories where you have local candidates who are known and trusted by local voters. Mm-hmm. It's a different thing at the national level, where I don't think you can win presidential campaigns.
Andy?
The one thing that we talk about a lot of parallels between where the Democrats are now and the Republicans were back in 94, both being kind of in the catbird seat in terms of national opinion. But the one place where they don't match up is that the Democrats don't have the equivalent of Newt Gingrich to rally the troops. The interesting thing is a recent Gallup poll, which showed a very unusual finding. A larger percentage of Democrats, 50%, saying they're going to be enthusiastic voters than Republicans, 38%. That's the reversal of what we usually see. What the Democrats lack is a national force or some way to make sure that that margin of 50% over 38% is maintained. And the Democrats who want to go out and vote with a vengeance, and I think a lot of it is voting with a vengeance, will have a rallying cry. There doesn't seem to be a rallying cry for Democrats as there was for Republicans back in 94.
And Ken Rudin, what we've been seeing lately, at least in the United States Senate, is an attempt to develop some rallying cries on the other side. The gay marriage amendment, which failed in the United States Senate this morning, but certainly something the Republicans hope will energize their base. The immigration bill, they're trying to get reconciliation between House and Senate versions, unclear as yet as to what they're going to come out with, if anything. And we're going to see a flag-burning amendment come up soon.
Exactly. If the Republican base is the evangelicals and the conservative, the hot-button conservative, they've been very disappointed. Immigration is not what they wanted to see come to the forefront, even though, I mean, the fact is they're going to have there's a Senate bill there that they are very unhappy about, and we don't know who's going to win in the end. They were not happy at all with Harriet Myers for the Supreme Court. They're not happy about this out-of-control spending that Congress has done. I mean, we haven't... President Bush will threaten a veto every 15 seconds, but nothing has come out of the White House, and they just keep spending and spending. The supplemental bill is just, billions and billions of dollars. And so they need something to at least get them happy. And even if gay marriage amendment was not going to go anywhere, and we knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, it, one, put the Democrats on record of where they stand on it, and two, look, we elected you in 2004, and we kept a Congress in 2004, and you owe us this, and that's what the Republican Party delivered.
And Matt Bayh, we only have a few seconds before the break, but the Republicans are seeming to try to invoke that word again, values that caused Democrats to cringe 2 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think it's causing a whole lot of cringing at this point. I mean, I do think, this has worked predominantly in turning out the conservative base in large numbers, while you knew as a Republican Party that moderates were essentially with you on a lot of the economic and cultural issues that define the Democratic Party. I don't think that's an assumption they have, and I think Andy's numbers back that up. You can't assume that this time.
More on politics when we come back from a short break with Matt Bayh of the New York Times, Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, and our own political junkie, Ken Rudin. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll also be talking about Jihad 2.0. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll wrap up our regular Wednesday feature, Political Junkie. NPR political editor Ken Rudin is with us in 3A. You can read more of Ken's thoughts on the primaries and the midterm elections in his Political Junkie column online at npr.org. Also with us, Matt Bayh, who writes about national politics for the New York Times Magazine, and Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. And before we leave the subject of the gay marriage amendment that went down in the Senate this morning, Andy Kohut, you said you had some interesting facts about Republicans feeling lost.
Why would Republicans feel this way? Back in the fall of last year, 58% of conservative Republicans said they thought President Bush was listening to their point of view. When we repeated the question this spring, that number had fallen to 44%. That is a measure of the extent to which the base feels lost, perhaps as a consequence of immigration, the budget deficit, any one of a number of things.
Matt Bayh, let me ask you, you're on your way to Las Vegas, where some people who form at least a part of the Democratic Party base are holding a meeting together face-to-face for the first time.
A small, loud part of the Democratic Party base. Yeah, this is an event called Yearly Coast, which I actually wrote about for the magazine the last couple of weeks. It is people who have blogged on the Daily Coast site, but it is not it's not the owner of that site. Marcos Melitez is not actually behind this. This is a bunch of volunteers who blogged on the site and decided to get together about a year ago or more and put together this convention. It's the first real convention of people on the site, of bloggers throughout the sort of liberal blog universe. And I think it's going to be about 1,000 people. And not only am I going to watch it, I'm actually sitting on a panel about the dreaded mainstream media, which I expect to be a painful experience.
Yes. interesting. They're drawing some high-profile names. Harry Reid, the minority leader in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, are both going to address the crowd. This is a chance to rub shoulders with the near great.
Howard Dean, Wesley Clark, Mark Warner. I mean, what's going on here is, politicians look at the blogosphere, if you want to call it that, and they say, we know we have to appeal. These people are very loud. They seem to be generating a lot of interest, but how do we talk to these people? We know how to talk to labor. We know how to talk to African-American voters. We know how to talk to Latino voters. Who do you pick up the phone and call when you want to lobby the blogs? And now they've got this wonderful thing that they really understand. It's a convention. Politicians get conventions. You show up, you give a speech, you shake a ton of hands, you sponsor a couple of events, and you're golden. And so they can't wait to get out there and meet all these folks, because for them it's finally a way to put this universe in the kind of context that politicians understand.
Let's get another caller on the line. Terry's with us. Terry calling from Virginia Beach.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is specifically about Florida. Where is Florida headed with midterms and also in the presidential year, and how much are things going to change with the Bush Jeb Bush no longer being governor? And what does it look like for Broward County, which seems to have an awful lot of Democrats with nothing to do?
Ken Rudin, we're going to throw that to you.
Well, the Republicans for the longest time tried to put Catherine Harris in a lockbox and just, you know, make her disappear, but she would not. She would not go away. She is and will be the Republican nominee for the Senate against Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson is kind of a nondescript first-term Democrat who could be beaten, perhaps, by a better Republican candidate. But Catherine Harris is too controversial. Her role in the 2000 recount still rankles with a lot of people. Even though Republicans would owe her a lot, they feel that there's no way she can appeal to swing voters, and she's probably going to bring the party down.
She's been tainted by corruption as well.
Well, she took some money involved in the same kind of a defense contractor that helped bring down Duke Cunningham, and even though she's returned the money, she has been linked with that. Another key race, and not so much in Broward County, but in, I think, Palm Beach County, or maybe it's Fort Lauderdale, which is Broward County, but Clay Shaw, who's been in Congress since 1980, a lot of senior citizens in that district, and while Clay Shaw has not done anything differently, the national mood may bring him down. They have a very good Democratic opponent named Ron Klein, who's going to run against him, and given the fact that the seniors are pretty upset about the prescription drug benefits, a lot of questions about that, Clay Shaw could be in serious trouble.
Thanks for the call, Terry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's get Jim on the line. Jim calling from San Diego.
Hi, I'm from an independent who is sympathetic to Democrats. I live in California. I will be voting for Schwarzenegger in the fall because I really believe that the government works best when we're in opposition, the assembly versus the governor. And I'm wondering, am I the only guy out here who feels that way?
Republicans nationally control, of course, the White House and both houses of Congress. And Andy Cohut, is there any polling on this?
I think a fair number of people feel some comfort when each party has a little bit of power. They certainly know find it easier to blame one party when they control both the Congress and the presidency. Although most polls show very few people vote strategically, there is, I think, on the part of a lot of people, some comfort in setting one off against the other.
Okay. Jim, thanks for the call. And let's last call. This will be Lori. Lori calling from Chagrin Falls in Ohio.
Yes, hi. I wanted to know the gentleman's opinion of Ken Blackwell and his latest move to, I'm a Democrat, so in my opinion, to suppress voter turnout and registration in our state, and the New York Times called today for him to recuse himself. I wonder if the gentleman think that's going to have any legs. Is that going to become problematic for Ken Blackwell in Ohio?
Mm-hmm. This is a story about voter registration drives in the state of Ohio, where Ken Rudin, the Republican Party, has been under siege of late.
That's true. And Robert F. Kennedy just had this article this week, I guess, in Rolling Stone, documenting, as he sees it, missteps or deliberate suppression of the vote by Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State in Ohio, which basically cost John Kerry the presidency. Blackwell is a very controversial figure, even with his own party, very conservative, very close ties with the evangelical churches. This is a controversy that he's involved in, and I think it just probably sets him back a little more. But I think it may give the Democrats even a bigger reason to come out and vote for Ted Strickland for the governorship.
Mm-hmm. But, Matt Bye, let me ask you about this. This is an electoral tactic. This is an effort to hold down the other side's vote. Is that maybe as the Secretary of State, he's supposed to be neutral, but he's a Republican Secretary of State. Don't both parties play this game on different levels?
Yeah, let me take a slightly contrarian view here. I mean, but let me stipulate, first of all, that of all the people who try to perpetrate these various schemes election to election, Ken Blackwell belongs in the Hall of Fame. He's just obviously this is something he's pretty shameless about. It's 2004 and now. His tactic in 2004, the courts just threw out, said you couldn't, you know, throw out registration sheets based on the size of the paper and all this, the thickness of the paper. So you know, certainly people in Ohio have a right to be concerned about that. That's
well, it. If you would let me, I kind of take it that when I hear that, you know, Mr. Cohut's poll believes that, you know, a lot of people are very concerned and Democrats are going to turn out more this year, let's say, than what Republicans are indicating thus far, that Mr. Blackwell is looking at the same thing and trying to find ways to make certain that the Democrats find it harder to turn out this year in Ohio.
Well, if I can go on, that may be, and I know Democrats are going to fight it, and they should, and that's all right and proper. The one thing I would say, I hear this all over the country. I think we all do all the time. The first thing, and I know when I was traveling with Howard Dean, he hears it all the time about electoral fraud. And in Ohio, it's a particular concern. But in general, I would have to say, you know, to go back to the caller's question earlier about having agenda items, having an affirmative agenda, that democracy doesn't – our democratic society doesn't really calibrate to work within like half a percentage point all that well. There have always been allegations of fraud here and there. In 1960, it benefited Democrats. In 2000, it benefited Republicans. And we should try and stamp this out. And we should try to have as fair a vote as possible. But if you really want to go out and defeat this problem, instead of spending all your time worrying about how elections are being stolen from you, go out and win an election. Go out and win it by 4 points. Go out and win it by 5 points. Stop trying to get to 50.5 every time. And that requires, I think, some deeper thinking and some philosophical overhaul. But that is, you know, my one feeling about this for Democrats is that you really, the goal here is not to get to 50.5 and keep Ken Blackwell from throwing out your votes. The goal is to go out, sell an agenda to people that actually has an affirmative impact on America in the 21st century and get to 55% of the vote. We won't have to have this conversation every midterm.
Lori, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Matt, bye. Have a good trip to Las Vegas.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And have fun at that panel. We'll look forward to the tomato stains. And Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press with us here in Studio 3. And as usual, our good friend Ken Rudin with us, political junkie. You can see his political junkie column again at npr.org.